All right. Thank you all for coming to Friday Gallery Talks. These are called In Conversations. They're an hour-long version of Friday Gallery Talks where we invite artists, scholars, staff to talk about a particular artwork. Within conversations, we take that interest in differing points of view and bring it to the auditorium where we either have DC area artists or one of our staff interview an artist on the stage here. So I'm going to introduce both of our panelists, or not panelists, but their conversation. Zoe Charlton was born in Tallahassee, Florida, and earned her master's in fine arts from the University of Texas at Austin. Zoe's to your left. Yeah. She's a faculty at American University in Washington, D.C., and lives in Baltimore, Maryland. Charlton has a solo and group exhibitions in New York, Baltimore, Austin, and Chicago, and she's received curatorial nominations for the Tiffany Foundation and the Whitney Biennial. Her mediums include drawing, painting, and video, and she is represented by Connor Contemporary in D.C. and Clementine Gallery in New York. Gada Amer was born in Cairo, Egypt, and has earned her master's in painting from the École des Beaux-Arts in Nice, France. Gada lives and works in New York and has solo and group exhibitions at such venues as Deitch Projects, New York, the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, the 2000 Whitney Biennial in New York, PS1 New York, the 2000 Gwangju Biennale in South Korea, and Site Santa Fe, New Mexico, the 1999 Venice Biennale, and she's represented by Gagosian Gallery. So Zoe will discuss with Gada, this seems very formal, will discuss with Gada how her research is part of a continuing three bodies of work. That one of the things that people, I think Gada is known for a certain body of work, but what we're trying to do is show a variety of work, ways she works, and a lot of these are based in research. So our conversation today will be about that. Gada has recently been part of a residency at the Smithsonian as an artist research fellow, and this is a competitive fellowship that brings artists from around the world to research the Smithsonian's collections. During this time, she worked with the George Hay Center in New York City, the National Museum of American Indian, and the Smithsonian American Art Museum. So if you'll please welcome our guests.
So I thought we'd start off by talking about the video. The title of the video is An Undigestible Dessert. Okay. And it's a collaborative performance and video with Reza Farkande.
Yes.
Will you talk about that a little bit? How did that start? How long have you been collaborating with Reza?
My collaboration with Reza dates since 2000 under the label RFGA, which stands for Reza Farkande and Gada Amer. And then we have started to sign pieces together two years ago. Mm-hmm. And Reza comes from video, so he was very helpful for me in this particular project, which he actually mainly directed the video and made the performance. I was invited by the American friend of the Tate Modern to work with for their fundraising. And they had the idea to make the artist work with their very famous chef called in this restaurant in New York called Saint Ambrose. I don't know if you know of it. And we could have the opportunity to work with a patisserie chef. And I thought it was a great idea. And I how to make a cake. For me, it was great because, of course, as a woman and as knowing my work, and it's something I've never done before. So I had the idea of eating Bush and Blair because of the Tate Modern and Bush because of the situation. So I wanted to invite people to eat it. And I talked to Reza about it, and he told me if it will not make sense if you don't make a performance, because it was after a dinner and we had three other cakes. So I thought it was a very appropriate idea. And then I told him to write the performance, and then we did the performance, and then we have been filming. And at the end, the experience was so fantastic that we decided to make it in a video. So,
well, you didn't just eat them; you hit them with mallets.
Yes.
Tell me about that. Why the mallet? Oh my God.
Why?
Was anybody else shocked? I was actually really surprised. I thought she might pull out a knife and sort of daintily cut slices out for everybody and just whacked them across the head.
No, I wanted, you know, like the first part and the last part were not directed. The first part, when Guido was doing the cake, we were really there watching him doing it, and then we made this the video to show that he's doing the cake, but we didn't direct him. Mm-hmm. And the last part, it was an invitation to the people to eat them, so we didn't direct them either. They came by themselves, and they just ate whatever and reacted to the cake. Mm-hmm. We didn't slice. We thought about, like, okay, shall we slice them? Shall we, you know? Mm-hmm. So we didn't do this. We thought it was more appropriate so that the people can, if they want, eat or not eat. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What kind of cake was it?
A raspberry mousse for Blair and a strawberry mousse for Bush.
Oh my God, that sounds delicious.
And the head was out of white chocolate. And the body is like all of the suits, like this, it's with the marzipan.
Mm. Wow. Wow. Are you guys going to collaborate some more? Are you going to make some more video pieces and performances?
I hope so. Hope so. I don't, you know, like it depends. Yeah, I like to work in video. He's very good as well, so it helps.
Okay. Well, let's start talking. Let's continue talking about another performance. And this is called The Reign of Terror. This was made in 2005.
2005, yes.
2005. And you install it in two places, at the Davis Museum and Cultural Center and at Wellesley College. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a little bit about this. And I think that probably just to give you guys a little bit more context, this is a shot of the cafeteria,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And here's an example of the pieces in its entirety. So it has a few components. It has the tableware, the plates, cups, cutlery, and this and wallpaper, right?
Correct.
And let me show you a detail of this tableware. Terrorism is not indexed in Arabic dictionaries. Let's talk about this piece.
But I wanted to show the next one, because
the next
this is
one. Uh-huh.
Related. And these are this is the wallpaper with the definition of the word terrorism since this word started in the dictionaries, basically since the French Revolution.
Is that good?
No.
Keep
yeah.
It. Okay.
So in this particular piece, I had, like, I was given two walls like this to make a piece, and then I thought I'm going to make one wall for the Arabic definition and the other wall for the American, and then the Arabic definition. So I was at Wellesley invited to do this just like special project. So I went to the library and looked at the definitions, and I took them out. They had a great library, actually, and great student to work with. And then for the Arabic, I looked, I couldn't find. So I called my sister, and she couldn't find. I spoke to the UN because they couldn't find. Went to the United Nations Library, and then only one definition. So it's impossible. So then I realized that it is a word that is very new. Mm-hmm. In how it was translated, and the translation is one translation of one of those definitions from the 60s. So I decided to do the piece differently. Then I wallpapered the two both walls, mm-hmm. and I put on the table where that the definition was not indexed in the Arabic dictionary.
Did your audience find that their conversations changed because of what they were eating off of?
You know, this was I'm surprised about the date. I thought it was done earlier. At that time, it was, even now, like, it was very difficult to talk about terrorism in any way because some of the students, they thought, they attacked me because they said, oh, it's not because the Arab doesn't have a word that you should treat us like this. Like, there was a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of reaction about this piece at the time, but in America. Mm-hmm. And I done this the same piece but I wanted to take it out of the context of the cafeteria, and I showed it just with the video and other pieces in Milan, in Italy. And it has a very different feel and reaction. So I don't know if it's because of the time or because of the countries. I don't know. I have no idea. So
let's go to the next one.
So in this one, I wanted to make a piece that would not be just an installation, that I could show it everywhere. So I decided still to take the only definition of the word terrorism in Arabic and embroider it on those armchair, like it's like a salon. And I made a handmade carpet out of silk and wool, very refined like carpet. Actually, I made this carpet in Egypt, and then I did the same wallpaper with the definition. So the point was for me that if you understand English and you don't understand Arabic, you would see the Arabic as decoration or doesn't exist, or and vice versa. So only when you grasp both languages, you will be able to understand the differences
or the entirety. You know, it's so interesting is that if we don't understand what it means in Arabic, we can't read it. We treat it as decoration.
Yes.
And oftentimes that's how people are treated, that we don't understand, as decorative sort of elements in the space.
Yes.
So I find that really interesting about this work. What is written on the couches, on the armchairs?
The same definition. Yes.
And
it's embroidered. I embroidered it, and then I left the thread over, like.
Well, do you want to talk right now about how you view this thread that's dangling?
Maybe we talk about it
with the
paintings.
With the paintings.
Yes.
What is on the carpet?
The definition of the word as well. Yes, the definition.
So there are so many associations with this color pink, right? So pink, you know, we think about femininity. We might think of passivity, homosexuality, left-wing politics, passion. What are some of your associations with pink?
You know, I like pink. So what? You know, I wanted to make a very beautiful place, but like innocent or something, and then you don't expect you're gonna so much charged with very heavy meanings, because people will think, oh, this is beautiful, and then they will go and then they will try, and then suddenly they are like, oh wow. And then I like this moment as well to make people, to draw people. It's like a lure, you know, like, oh, yeah, I'm beautiful. And then it's just something that they cannot get away with. Or they have to come in and then they have to think about it, take position anyways, you know, because nobody from far can. They know there is letters and it's beautiful and it's all pink and nice and you're drawn into it. So it's a trap.
It is a trap. Ah, so I see what you're up to.
And you know, like the wallpaper is done with like old colonies, you know, the furniture as well. I worked a lot on the like
the design of the entire space.
Yes.
Let's move to this set of four paintings and their definitions. This is the definition of freedom.
In Arabic.
And I'm going to just go through the other three and then we could talk about them. Definition of peace.
Of love.
And this one.
Peace. Security.
And security. Why those words?
Because I showed those four definitions. I showed the Salon Courbet and the video in my last show. This is really basically, and two other definitions. I don't know if you have them, but anyway, it's about fear.
Oh, right. We don't have the two, but they're in English.
One in English, one in Arabic. It's a diptych, and I showed them. It was in one show. This was my last show in Milan, and for me, it was about, of course, what's going on in the world, and I wanted to. I rarely work with Arabic language because I thought I always work with the language that people can understand. But here deliberately I wanted that people don't understand, because always it is associated with very negative, like the Arab world now, the Muslim world is associated with a lot of negativity, as if those words doesn't exist in our dictionaries or if we don't carry with us. So I decided to just embroider them. And the title is in English, but so we know what we're looking at, but we don't understand same thing. decorative doesn't exist for us. This doesn't exist anyway because we don't understand. Mm-hmm.
Now, this piece is called Today 70% of the Poor in the World Are Women. This was made in 2001, and this is in Spain. It's installed in Spain. And this is a
Barcelona,
Spain. This is a really wonderful image, and so I thought we could start with this one. Okay. But just to give everyone a sense of the scale of this piece, so here you have mothers playing in the garden. Mm-hmm. And then here's the piece in its entirety. I mean, this is pretty huge. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, all my garden idea came has been developed with another curator, Rosa Martinez, who really, really was the curator who gave me the opportunity, encouraged me to develop those pieces, mm-hmm. except two pieces. But all my garden pieces have been done with Rosa Martinez. She
was did you garden already?
No,
why
no,
a garden?
No, I'm very bad in gardening.
Why a garden?
Because I was asked one day to do something outside, and I wanted to find like something that would relate to embroidery. Mm-hmm. For women, like a woman's activity. So I thought, oh, gardening is a good woman's activity. So this is how I started the whole, so all outdoor, even if it doesn't have really plants in it, but it is not, it's always gardens for me.
Okay.
But sometimes it has plants, so it's not.
And here's the next one.
Yeah.
This is the Peace Garden. Mm-hmm. And as you can see, it's a large peace sign. What is the size of this piece?
Oh, it's huge.
It's like the size of this.
Yeah.
Okay. Huge. Now, this is where it gets really exciting. So here are three attendants, and they're serving samples of bloodworms and crickets.
Alive.
and so what you invited the attendants to do, people to do, is take those and feed them to the plants.
Right.
These plants are carnivorous plants. So,
and I did this piece before American attacked Iraq. This is why I did this piece, actually. This is 2 months before American attacked.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I did it as a protest for myself, for the audience. So I invited people to a cocktail party where they have to give peace.
And you were talking about how hesitant people were in the very beginning.
Yes.
To do this.
They were disgusted because of the worms and because they couldn't. Because, you know, they are in suits. It was from Art Basel, Miami, the first, so everybody was, very nicely dressed. And, you know, they were. And then suddenly they were just, becoming,
kids.
And, can I try? So it was funny. It was a very successful piece, actually.
All right. Now, is this piece still installed?
No, none of my gardenist pieces are permanent. I just opened my first permanent piece in France, actually, 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. All of those pieces are this was for 1 week. Mm-hmm. The Barcelona piece was for 1 week.
Okay.
You know, it was very experimental for me at the time, and as well, you know, nobody, I don't know, it's pieces that...
So how did you decide on those particular plants? What sorts of things did you do to get ready for this installation, or any of the gardens?
Well, I wanted to do a peace sign with the carnivorous plants. This is what's very clear. Well, no, I was asked to do a piece, so I said, okay, what am I going to do when this the war is going to come, and then this, and then I got this idea, and then I had to go in the internet to find what kind of plants I need, or I can buy with my budget. And actually, it was very interesting because the carnivorous plant turned out to be an endangered species. And actually, they come from Florida, Miami, but they have been endangered because they have been building a lot of... so they have almost disappeared, which was... I found that... I didn't... You know, things I research, I don't know. I just have the idea, and then I go into, things that I have to figure out... accidents and stories. So I had to buy those plants from Texas and import them to Florida. And it was very complicated because you cannot import because of this agriculture, I don't know what. So I had to have somebody specialist to come and clear it out of custom. So it was a very, you know, I it was a huge piece, expensive, so I couldn't choose the plants mm-hmm. that I really wanted, but it's okay.
Okay. So this is Women's Qualities 2000, and it's in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And the each plot spells out a quality, mm-hmm. right? What are some of the qualities?
It's sexy, beautiful, existing eyelashes, presenting well the food, submissive.
Wow. And who gave you those qualities?
I was given those seven plots to do something, a garden, and actually it was again with Rosa, and when she showed me the picture, I said, I was in New York, so like I have no idea. She said, no, you have to do a garden. I said, no, I can't. I don't know what to do. I really don't know. And then I am very, very bad with images. Mm-hmm. I have to be like to see, to feel. I don't know. So with the images, for me, it was said, no, I have no idea really. And she was like, yeah, you have to. She told me, okay, I'll fly you there. If you have an idea, it's fine. If you don't have an idea, it's fine too. You just party with us to the opening. I said, okay, it works.
That's great.
So I was like, oh my God. Then I didn't have stress, so I wasn't stressed about like me producing
something.
So I said, okay, cool. So I went and immediately, I don't know why, because it was it was the Triennale. And then when I saw this, I don't know, immediately I have this idea to do this, to ask people what do they, like, this was my first time in Korea, so it was such, like, as if I arrived in another world, you know? Nobody speak English as well. This was very interesting. So I decided to ask, make a survey of the people working in the museum, the people who are just going out next to the museum, and ask them what is, for them, woman's quality.
And you asked men and women.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I took the seven that are the most recurrent. I cheated because I added the intelligent. This is my...
That's your... Thank goodness. And what type of plants are they?
Oh, it's a plant that is very resistant in Busan, and it's... I don't know the plant. Uh-huh. I don't know the plant's name, but it's blooms, this red bloom, for 2 months, and then that's it.
And that's it.
Yeah. So I have to, as well, on the spot to go and find the plant. But this was in 1 week. It was very quick. I have to, we went to the garden, the gardeners, and
And it's also, you're lucky because it bloomed when you were.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Luck.
Oh my goodness. Did you say you don't agree
like
with
this.
Luck?
Sometimes I'm less lucky, but.
That's a beautiful piece. Okay, so this is some of the work that we're most familiar with, mm-hmm. and this is a combination of paintings and sculptures, mm-hmm. and this is called Barbie Loves Ken, mm-hmm. and the year of this piece is
95.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and are they life size, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Straight jackets.
Straight.
For Barbie and for Ken.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so tell me about your process of making these.
This was challenging to make them size life size, mm-hmm. In this piece. So it's a straight jacket for Barbie and Ken.
Did you base the measurements off of actual people?
No, actually off Barbie and
off
Ken.
Off of Barbie? Oh, okay.
Yes, I bought Barbie and Ken, uh-huh. and I had to plaster them. I had to, it drove me crazy basically because I couldn't find a way to do them because I'm not, I took some classes before I did this and another piece of sewing, like sewing classes so that I could make the pattern, but this one I've never... So I had to invent my way, but it took me 6 months in order for me to get it together. Mm-hmm. I actually molded Barbie and Ken with a very soft fabric with a gel medium. Then I made like cuts so that I can sew. Then I cut them, then I flattened them, Then I drew the pattern, very small, it's crazy. Then I enlarged them. And then I put them together.
Yeah.
And then I just, so this, it was very challenging in the how to make them for me.
Mm-hmm. And you've, you know, it's so interesting because you've said this numerous times, but you let your subject matter dictate the media that you use. And I think you let you use the materials that are necessary for mm-hmm. a particular idea, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, I'm a painter. You know,
yes,
you're a painter
correct.
Or a mm-hmm. sculptor or what have you. Mm-hmm. And I also found that really exciting, you know, especially a lot of contemporary artists will do this, mm-hmm. but I love the way that you talk about that. Mm-hmm. And it seems, and I don't know about the rest of you, but when I started looking through an entire bodies of work, I started thinking, my God, there's sculpture, there are gardens, there. How does all of this relate? And it all relates with this, with, you know, I'm not going to even say that word. I won't say it.
No, you can.
Because I did,
and
they said, bad joke. But there's a common sort of theme that runs through everything. Mm-hmm. And did you guys know what I was going to say?
Yes.
Thank you. Exactly. I want to do it. So, and it's also exciting for me to see that, to see the way that you can translate different ideas in different ways, and you're really courageous to do it. You know, even things that you don't know, going to another country and not knowing what you're going to do.
Yeah,
that's
it's like my
stressful.
Research here in a way. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
like exactly this. I for the Smithsonian, I said, oh, what? I really this is a good opportunity to talk because really
yeah,
it is exactly
definitely.
The same. It's a risk. Huh? It's, mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm lucky, sometimes I'm less lucky, but always it ends up with something.
Mm-hmm.
I came to this country in 1996, actually November 17, 1995, exactly, to be like, and I became American, mm-hmm. and then as well, September 11 happened, and all of this body of work happened, and then I was very upset, and I'm still very upset, and then I looked around myself, like, but where are the Indians? I don't know one American. Where are they? I don't see them. You know, like, I was very, suddenly I got anxiety. It's like, what is going on? Why don't we see them? In New York, huh? And then I got the opportunity to do I was asked to apply which museum I want to go to see. I said, the Indian Museum, because this is something I don't
yeah.
know. What I want to do, I don't know. I don't know. I just wanted to see where they are, why they are disappearing. They are, for me, in New York, as well, somebody who lived 10 years, I have never. Yes, maybe I saw. I have encountered two American Indians.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And so I was fascinated by their disappearance,
mm-hmm.
mostly. And then I started to do.
What are some of the interesting things that you found so far?
The most interesting thing that I found, many things. One of the most challenging that I cannot find the. The tribe that has disappeared. This is what I'm interested in, because I didn't know what I want to do. Then I went to the Hay Center. I read the history books.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came here and I went to the museum and I bought a cookbook, a lot of things that would relate to them, so I can mm-hmm. get familiar, and went to eat in the restaurant, look at the bees, bought a bee thing, like a cover, like a little bee. So what I was very interested, like now, because the research has evolved, then I got the idea to work on to know the name of the tribe. So I looked at the book and then I tried to know the name of the tribe. So there's a lot of books on the name of the tribes that are still existing. Then I was interested to know, so where are the tribes that have disappeared or they have been killed, exterminated? And this is what I'm encountering right now, that nobody knows or nobody has records.
Mm-hmm.
I find this fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe they have a record, but we cannot find them.
We can't follow it, yeah.
But I want to really pursue this this path, because I think this, in terms of my work and in terms of what I wanted to say about the disappearance, they're being transparent in a way,
mm-hmm.
We want to make them transparent. I don't know what is the deal, but this is the most fascinating.
Okay.
And as well to see the American Museum and how It's interesting. It's mm-hmm. very. It's a very in within this American society that I became part of. There is an American side that is a little bit occult, because, for example, with the history of the African American, it's like we talk about it. It's known. It's mm-hmm. But with the history of the American Indian, I think it's kind of a taboo. I think.
Well, it's strange, when you said that you live in New York, and when you're running around to the outskirts of New York, you see a presence of you see the names of towns.
Exactly.
And that's really the only way that you'll immediately notice. I think that's the most obvious way.
Right.
But you're right. There is a sort of invisible
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the Lumbaw tribe. Mm-hmm. And how there are less than 5,000 in this tribe, and where are they? Who are they? Mm-hmm. Are they registered? What's mm-hmm. going on? So, mm-hmm. yeah, you're right. I'm glad that you're doing this research.
Let's see.
This burqa. What year?
95.
And
no, 96. 96.
And it's there's an insert.
It's a burqa. Uh-huh. So it's something that burqa.
Yeah, that's tied right.
That you do your face with. This I did when it was very bad. Like in Egypt, it's like conservatism is more and more like uh-huh. More and more. And one day I was like, okay, next time I'm in Egypt, they will force me to wear burqa. I'm sure.
Where does this sort of enter? Where is that?
Here.
Right here. Oh.
So I did my own burqa. This uh-huh. is the burqa that I would wear if I'm forced to wear it.
Uh-huh.
So I did out of laces here, like hand-made laces, the definition of the word fear in Arabic. It's my first actually Arabic piece here. So it looks like a sexy clothes and the garment. I wanted to play with this, of course. With
looks
out
like
of
a halter top.
Yes,
right.
Yeah, it looks like whatever. So. But it ties here and here, those things for the eyes, and here it goes like this. And here I did the definition of the word fear in Arabic out of jade pearls and laces.
Okay. Okay. And this is Julius Pink.
Yes.
Okay. And this is the beginning of the paintings. We'll look at a lot of the paintings.
Right.
And so now let's talk about the thread and painting and. Mm-hmm. embroidery and mm-hmm. the dangling tassels and mm-hmm. and this content, because hold on, can I have that magazine? I just love this, the front, and I thought this is the question. I'm kind of tethered. It says, what makes art erotic? And I thought, oh, this is great.
I make it erotic.
You make it erotic. That's right.
Talk to me. It's like
so let's talk about your definition of painting. How you define painting?
Well, it's anything applied on the surface. This is painting. I'm going to tell you why I started to do this painting, because it has a story, and it was a very, as well, very long and painful research that took from 1988 to 1993.
Hmm.
So I have to present myself in now. So I'm Egyptian. I moved to France when I was 11 because my parents were doing a PhD in chemistry and in law. Mm-hmm. And so I was young, and so I moved there in the 1974. Egypt was at the time, I thought, normal, like no veil, no particular sign of religious something, because it was under Nasser, anyway, communist, and etc. Then I started to go back in Egypt in the 80s. And the more I go back to Egypt, the more I found veiled women. And I was like, what's going on? And those women was not like in the Iranian Revolution who have been forced to wear the veil, but they were wearing them because they wanted to wear them.
But
they were not. They were not forced by the men. They were, nobody told them to wear it. They just deliberately started to wear them and to have this kind of religious speaking and things that I was like, okay, it's as if people were brainwashed. 1988, I found a magazine called Venus, mm-hmm. and it's a special magazine for veiled women. And with this magazine, there was a, it's like Burda. I don't know if you know Burda. The Burda magazine is how you do your own dress. So I bought this magazine, and I don't know why, I knew that this was something very important for me in the development of my art. I don't know why, I just have to buy this magazine. And I did like a lot of research, cutting this pattern out, doing a lot of stuff. In 1988 as well, it was my first, second year of painting in the Beaux-Arts of Nice. I had a teacher that would forbid to, that would don't want to teach painting to women. Same year, in France.
Really, in France.
Mm-hmm. And nobody, this was normal.
And what year, wait, what year is this?
1988. Actually, 1987, because I started to take classes. He wouldn't come. He made me fail in all my painting credit. And I couldn't paint, basically. And then there was, he would open only the class technical for the men. And then we had to wait outside and ask all of our question to the men that would report to him. So I was very upset about the situation in general. I was very upset about the situation back home. And then I said to myself as well, like within the year, like I don't want to only talk about Muslim women because it will just make it, you point out just one group of people. Well, I wanted to really talk about the whole group of women. So slowly by slowly I developed this tick. I wanted to paint with red, like after this magazine, because it was has to do with the clothing anyway, like this. So I decided to replace the brush with the needle, and my aim was to paint with, really to make painting with the thread.
Abstract paintings.
They're not abstract. It's, no? They're not abstract. They are...
Those drips?
Yeah, then abstract, like a mixing. Like they are a painting of women masturbating or pleasing themselves. Uh-huh. So it's... for me, it was very important to take as well the image from men's world. So making all of this blurry frontier between this is woman's world and this is men's world.
Mm-hmm. And the title of this piece?
KSKC.
Now, KSKC, what does that stand for?
Kansas, Kansas City.
Ah, I was
actually...
What was going on in Kansas? Yes. Were you there? Did you travel there?
A lot of, yeah, I did a residency there. A lot of my piece... Title of my piece, like Julius Pink, it has the mm-hmm. title of my assistants or places that have been made, or like Kansas City. I used to have some people embroidering for me in Kansas City, but I didn't know that you have to put Kansas City first and then Kansas after.
Because so, there's Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah. Right. So I just when I after I finished drawing them, I just marked them so that I know where they're going. I don't know. So I have put Kansas City, and then my assistant told me, no, it's KSKC. I said, oh, it's okay. So I decided to call this piece KSKC.
And this is Gray Kiss.
Yeah.
Now this is one of the few that I've seen on black.
No,
with a dark
have a
ground.
Black series.
You have a black series?
Yes, I have a black series.
I would love to see the rest of those.
Yeah,
Gray Kiss.
This is RFGA, for example. Like
yeah.
An example of
Let's look at this one. This is colored square.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so there are sections. Now, how is this constructed? Now, is it just one large canvas that's been sectioned out?
You know, I paint first. I start to paint the canvas as if in a hole. I don't sew in small and then sew them together. So I paint first, then I do my composition with my figures, and then I unroll the canvas, and I roll it onto two rolls, and then I stitch by hand. A lot of people, they think it's by machine, but it's actually by hand. And then I stretch it again, and then with those thread that are done within the embroidery itself, I gel medium it.
Oh, okay.
So they work like my drips.
Okay. You know, it's so interesting when on closer inspection of your pieces, I'm really aware of how methodical it is. Mm-hmm. And then also the sort of activity, the way that you're embroidering is such a personal thing. stuffing and their imperfections in the work and the stitching. Mm-hmm. Will you talk a little bit about those imperfections and your decisions to leave some of those and how that might relate to the content of this work, of this particular body?
You know, I have a lot of help as well in my work, and so, you know, when you do something by hand, you cannot be perfect, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just like things happen, and sometimes it's from... You know, it has to be good for me. The most important thing, it has to be a nice lines, like drawing. You know when you draw.
Yes.
You know, sometimes you just there is something that happens, and you just are not. The line is not perfect, but still it works in the drawing. So it's the same idea.
Yeah.
I always tell my assistant not to follow my lines, just to draw. Like this is try to redraw it, because I always redraw it, because you know the canvas is thick. It's not very smooth, so when I outline my lines, they are sometimes it's like I slide and stuff like this. So I have always my drawing next to them. They have to follow the drawing.
Okay, what is your day like in your studio? So what do you do?
Oh, if I'm at the studio.
If you're at the studio, I'm always curious what other artists do. Do you get up in the morning and have coffee and? Start reading Venus again, and
no.
What do you do?
Depends on which project I'm working on, because I work on many. You see, and I work on many projects at the same time. Uh-huh. I don't work on just painting, and then I can work on garden project, like painting and another video in the same time. Like right now, I'm working on a group of painting, and I'm working on some collaboration drawing with Reza, and I'm working on. I'm trying to make this research here in Washington, and I'm preparing a show in the Brooklyn Museum. So it's depends.
Oh wow! All over. Okay. So hold on. Let's move on. Here's another image. What is the title of this piece?
Pink? No, something like this.
Mm-mm.
Pink.
Is it pink?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh?
Or Julius Pink? Something like that.
And so you glean a lot of your images from media. So what are some of the magazines that you have laying around your studio?
No, all my paintings is from porn magazine.
Aha.
So
okay.
This is,
Who chuckled? Somebody chuckled. Okay. And you're copying them exactly?
No, I draw them. I redraw
you draw
them.
Uh huh. Okay.
I don't have a model. People ask me if I have models and stuff. Mm-hmm. No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to end. Our last slide is called Love Hurts. And this is a collaborative drawing.
Yes.
With Reza.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a large body of this work.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys have been collaborating for about 2-3 years now.
Yes, doing them with both names, and with more. You know, I started collaborating with Reza in 2000, as I told you, because he was very depressed. He had the depressed physically. He had a very severe depression. He couldn't move. He was basically letting himself die. And he was at my studio, and I was very, very hurt by this. And then he started to get better. And one day, I was out of town, and he just painted on my canvas. And I was like, okay, what's going on now? I was very scared, but in the same time, it was very beautiful, layers of paint. And so I decided to embroider on them. And then we would have all of this conversation for 5 years until he was better. He could communicate. It was a very weird, strangest situation that I have encountered in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided to, all of this conversation that we still have to label them RFGA as a tribute to him, and just as well to see where it is going. And it has really made my work evolve and stuff like this. And 2 years ago, I asked him if he would collaborate with me, because we have such this already this language that we have already together, and with going more to and taking more of his. Because he makes a lot of watercolors and lots of things with natures and stuff like this, taking more of his own vocabulary and making this series of work. And I didn't know if it would work, because we said, I guess that if we decide this, it's going to be a fiasco. So we said, let's try it. And then we started with prints because nobody wants print, nobody cares, my gallery doesn't care. So I said, okay, let's do those prints. Mm-hmm. And then it developed to this very huge body of
printmaking. You know, I noticed in the collaborative work, there are a lot of images of flowers,
yes.
sort of these cloud-like forms,
yes.
And you know, Snow White, Disney characters.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So why the Disney characters? Why all the floral patterns?
But he does a lot.
Patterns.
He does a lot. Reza, I studied with him. I know him since actually 1988, the same year of my magazine. So we studied together in the same school, and we have always like shared studios. Actually, we have had a lot of subject in common that we painted, but he liked more like nature and flowers and as well Disney characters and stuff like this. So we had, and I have a lot of Disney characters in my drawings, and so it's, I don't know. It's there's no reason why. It's just this is our interest. Is,
okay.
You know.
Well, let's open it up.
Right?
Okay. Are there any questions? Yes.
Barbie loves Ken. Barbie loves Ken, and Ken loves Barbie. No, Ken loves Barbie. Is it as a punishment?
Another question? Yes.
I'm sure it will. I don't know yet, but if I don't like to talk about my artwork before it's done, because it's always it changes every day or every so. No, we'll see. Actually, we'll see as well, depending on what I'm gonna find. Will I find this list or not? If I don't find it, what I'm gonna do? If I find it, you know, it's very. We'll see. No, I hope it will. This is the idea, but because because I'm very sensitive to this idea. I really. I don't know. Okay. We'll see.
Anyone else? Yes.
I don't find it problematic. I find it like I use specific material for specific ideas. Like I cannot do use like thread and do a garden for this. It's impossible. I find it more. Of course, it's easier for me to embroider to stay at my studio. It's the best. I am only the only one who controls. Like I'm when as soon as I go out of my studio, I am a little bit. I have to deal with so many people, so many as well. Things that happens,
right.
And I'm not used
well, things
to
change,
it.
Yeah.
And people, and difficulties, and materials, and things, and heavy, and a lot of and rains.
You're kind of at the whim of
yeah.
the elements and the other people's
yes.
thoughts.
Exactly.
And,
yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and even in my sculpture piece, I find it already, because I have to deal with a lot of, for example, for Salon Courbet, it was the wallpaper people, and then the rug maker, and the furniture maker, it was so many people, and the embroiderer I find it interesting, but very frustrating and very difficult to, when I do a piece, I'm so happy. That's why I do like one piece a year, two maximum.
Of the larger installations.
It's very difficult. It's
I have a question. Are there certain circumstances in which you, let's say, farm out the embroidery to embroiderers, and other circumstances in which you want to do the embroidery yourself, or is it a matter of happenstance?
I always have an embroidered piece at home because it calms me down. So, but it's impossible if I have to do it myself. It's impossible that I develop. I only would embroider. I would make two pieces a year, and that's it. I would not make garden project. I would not do. It's not very important that I do it myself, really, because it's very mechanical in a way. Mm-hmm. For me, I find it more exciting to to compose and to draw. And then a little bit when I have. Sometimes I'm not so sure about the color, for example. Mm-hmm. So I have to work with this, or I tell them like this, and I'm more involved. And sometimes it's, I know because of how I did how many. You know, I know more or less how it's gonna turn out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was wondering what the scale of some of the order pieces are.
Some of them are huge, some of them are small. Like those one that you saw, it's something like 70 inch by 72. Mm-hmm. And I have pieces that are, don't know the inches, but 3 meter by 4.
What is that?
No, 3 meter by 4.
Oh, you mean the really? There's other ones. The collaborative. The other one. Okay.
The collaborative work are the paper is very difficult to embroider on paper.
Uh huh.
It's large.
So you're working larger than the, what is that?
8 by 8. Meter is
yeah.
Like this. Yeah. My best pieces are the largest ones.
The
yes, but the, I think because it has this painting scale and this and then you really can go in, like look at them from right. Inside and then yes. It's like,
wow.
I don't know how many feet. It's big.
It's huge.
Oh. It's very complicated to do. This as well, it's.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's not very easy.
You had a question? Should I go back
yeah,
to.
Yeah, and then you can zoom in, maybe?
I don't think I can zoom in.
You cannot?
I don't know how to do that.
No, you don't know.
I know.
So, wait, I
look at that. Here we go.
You see, you can see that. Yeah, they are.
One more? Okay. And someone raised their hand up here. Yes.
What are the backgrounds of the people you work with that do the embroidery? Are they art? Do they have an art background? Are they highly skilled seamstresses?
Or other artists, or
they are artists, designers, women who just or men who just know how to sew. Hmm. Actually, I form them. I have to teach them how to sew my way, because it's different.
Basic skills.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I have to like as well very detailed works.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you guys for coming.
Thank you, Dada.